This is Dr. Roger Green in his course, Reformation to the Present. This is session number 9 on Puritanism.
Okay. All right. I'm on page 12 of the syllabus, if that's, you know, if you're there. Oh, and we don't need to talk about the exam today. We'll talk about it on Friday. And after we go through the text, and I'll have the exam with me, so I'll be able to kind of look at the exam and make sure you're all on target in terms of what you should be studying and everything. So we'll lecture today, lines done on Friday, exam on Monday, and then next week we'll lecture on the Wednesday and Friday. We won't do a discussion group on the Friday the next week. So, okay, so this is page 12 of the syllabus. This is lecture number 4, The Theology of Puritanism in the Free Church and the Expansion of Puritanism to the New World, which that's about where we are. So first of all, England's religious history before Puritanism. Okay. Now, one thing we tried to say was that, kind of as a reminder, that geographically, we've changed a bit in terms of this time, because the Reformation that we've seen has been Germany under Luther and Switzerland under Calvin, but now it's moving over to England, and there's a Reformation taking place in England, and then that some of the expression of that is going to come to the States, or to America rather, so that's why we said the expansion of Puritanism to the New World. So we talked about that. Then number B, the development of Congregationalism in the Baptists. So first we talked about Congregationalism. We mentioned the theology of the Puritans. Oh, I didn't get this up here. Let me just do this. We mentioned the theology of the Puritans. And for our purposes, the theological discussion has shifted in a sense from justification by faith and assurance, but now it has shifted a bit to the whole business of ecclesiology. So the Puritans were very concerned about church matters. And the two major concerns could be broken down into the liturgy of the church. They felt that the Anglican church was too Catholic still, not reformed enough, and also to church polity, or how you run the church. They didn't like this business of running the church by some kind of hierarchical government. They'd rather run the church by the congregation, let the people have a say in running the church and so forth. So liturgy and polity became two kind of driving forces for them, no doubt. So then the English independent movement, we gave a background. We talked about the pilgrims coming to America. Then C, we talked about Puritan immigration to America and the shaping of American congregationalism. Now, let me just make sure that we covered that, the shaping of American congregationalism. Okay, we haven't quite finished that. Number C. Okay, we mentioned that there were literally tens of thousands of Puritans who came over to these shores. And probably I didn't stress enough the other day, in fact, that where did these Puritans come? They came to the very place where we are. That's where they came to. They came over to Boston and what we call the North Shore, places like Ipswich and places like that. So this is Puritan country up here. This is largely where the Puritans settled along the coastline here. So we're really in the middle of it here. So remember, when they came, they weren't particularly happy with that colony down in Plymouth, though. Remember, we mentioned that, because the Plymouth colony, they were separatists, they were independents, they were people who had left the church. The Puritans, on the other hand, wanted to reform the church from within, wanted to purify the church, so that's their name. I think what we didn't do is the shaping of American Congregationalism. So we do want to mention the shaping of American Congregationalism now. And there's just one word that I'm... I didn't do this very well at all, so here's a word I want to just kind of mention here, and it's the Cambridge Platform. Okay, the Cambridge Platform. Cambridge Platform took place in 1648, so we should take note of the Cambridge Platform, 1648. And what is that? Well, as a matter of fact, the pilgrims who were down in Plymouth, they were basically congregationalists, right? They thought that you should, they're independent separatists, but they thought that how should you run the church? You shouldn't run the church by some kind of a hierarchy. You should run the church by the congregation, all right? And the Puritans in Boston, who didn't like the separatists, as we've mentioned, but the Puritans in Boston and other places, like up here in what we call the North Shore, they were also congregationalists in terms of form of government. But what happens by 1648 is that the Puritans in this country, they're no longer in an Anglican church to be able to purify an Anglican church. They are quite distant from the mother churches in England. So what's happening is they're really building their churches and forming their congregations after congregational polity. So in that sense, the Puritans, they're not going to Anglican churches anymore. They're not Anglicans like they were in England, staying in the Anglican church to try to reform the Anglican church. They're pretty full-fledged congregationalists. So, as a matter of fact, the Puritans here and the separatists in Plymouth, what they decide to do, very natural thing, they decide to come together. Let's join together. So in 1648, the Cambridge Platform is the joining together of Puritans and the Independents to form Congregationalism, to form kind of a denomination. So it takes shape in this country in 1648. So they're no longer kind of at enmity with each other. They kind of come together in this wonderful agreement. And this became known as the Charter of American Congregationalism. So in 1648, you've got Congregationalism established here on these shores. Now remember, we said one of the prevailing doctrines that these people were trying to talk about was ecclesiology. So this is how they have decided, in terms of the doctrine of ecclesiology, this is how they've decided to shape their churches by congregational means, and so forth. So Congregationalism is born. Now, I don't know your background, so maybe on the last day we can talk a little bit about that, but some of you may be Congregationalists. Maybe that's your kind of denominational affiliation. And if it is, it dates back to technically to 1648 and to this charter that was established. So that's Puritan immigration to America and the shaping of American Congregationalism. Are there any questions about that? Do we get this, you know, we're seeing these kind of independent movements taking shape here. And this is the time when all of that is happening and ecclesiology becomes the dominant kind of theological issue here. Okay? All right, let's go to the Baptists. Some of you may be Baptists, and maybe that's your background. And so let's go to the Baptists and give an introduction, and then outline continues on page 13. But let's just give an introduction to the Baptists. And I've got to just go back a bit here, if you'll just allow me here to go back here. There were two people lived in England, two leaders. A man by the name of John Smith, and I think we have his dates there, right, and he was a friend with a man by the name of Thomas Helwys. This name is pronounced Helwys if you're looking for pronunciation, but Smith and Helwys, okay? Okay, now they're associates. These two people are associates, and their independence, they're not within the Anglican Church. They've decided we're going to leave the Anglican Church. And they left the Anglican Church about 1608 or so. So these people are independents. But they also decide, there's another kind of ecclesiological issue that they decide. They decide that all this infant baptism that all these people are doing, the Catholics baptize infants, the Anglicans baptize infants, other independents baptize infants, other separatists baptize infants, we don't think that's right. We think the Bible teaches an adult baptism. So so they find refuge. They're not welcomed, of course, in England because they believe this. So they find refuge where? Where are they going to go for refuge? We mentioned this the other day. They're going to go to what country or to where? They're going to go to the Netherlands. Remember we said the Netherlands were the place of kind of religious toleration. Now, they happen to go to Amsterdam, and this is something I wouldn't advise today, but John Smith was so convinced about adult baptism that he baptized himself in Amsterdam in one of the canals. Now, maybe the canals were a lot cleaner then than they are today, at least from what I've seen anyways, and maybe they're a lot nicer to dunk yourself in 1608 than they are today. That's what he decided to do. He wanted to make a point, and the point was adult baptism by full immersion, that's what I'm going to do. And so Smith and Helwys really are the kind of the introduction to this whole business of people who call themselves the Baptists. Now, that leads us to the next page, to page 13, and we'll see the general Arminian Baptists, the Calvinist Baptists, forming of associations and division within the ranks. So first, under B, the first group of Baptists, certainly Smith and Helwys, were what were called General Baptists or Arminian Baptists. And the reason they were called General Baptists or Arminian Baptists was because they put an emphasis really upon free will. God gives his grace to people, and people by their free will can either say yes to God or no to God. And because of their emphasis on this freedom of the will to say yes or no to God, they became known, they got this title as General or Arminian Baptist after the teachings of Jacob Arminius. So they became, that was really kind of the beginning of the Baptist movement, and some and Smith and Helwys, eventually, long story short, but Smith died in 1612, and so Helwys decided to move a little congregation back to London, and so that's where he formed the first Baptist congregation in London. Smith was dead. You can see the 1612, Helwys lived another 4 years, but in 1612 he moved back to London, formed a little denomination, and they called themselves the General Baptists or the Arminian Baptists. So that's how they all start. That's how they begin. But lo and behold, number C in your outline, about 1638, there were a group of Baptists who decided, no, we don't believe in free will the way Smith and Helwys has talked about it. We are not Arminian Baptists or General Baptists. We are Calvinist Baptists. So the Calvinist Baptists start a congregation in 1638 in London. So they, these Calvinist Baptists are emphasizing not freedom of the will, but the things we talked about with John Calvin, especially double election. So starting at 1638, you've got another group of Baptists being formed there and called the Calvinist Baptists or sometimes called Particular Baptists, but I don't have that name down there. But sometimes these people are called Particular Baptists. So, okay. Now, number D, the forming of associations. The forming of associations becomes really, really important here for these Baptists, especially these people in London. This is where it all starts. So, okay. Now, I don't know if any of you are Baptists. Maybe you're all Baptists. I don't know. But for Baptists, where is the center of authority for Baptists? Is it in some authoritative denominational leadership? Is that where the center of authority is for Baptists? Or is it somewhere else? Where is it? If any of you are Baptists, what's that? Scripture certainly is the foundation for authority. And then who gets to kind of interpret the scripture, Jesse? Who does the denominational leader interpret the Bible? Who gets to kind of tell us what this means, generally speaking, in the Baptist tradition? Anybody want to take it? What's that? The pastor and the local church, the congregation, the local church. The center of authority for the Baptist tradition is in the local church. Now, we've got all kinds of Baptist denominations, so we're just speaking generally here, but the local church is the center of authority. And who ordains? In the Baptist tradition, who has the right, in a sense, to ordain? Is it the denomination or is it the local church? it's the local church. Technically, the right to ordain, the authority to ordain, rests in the local church. So that is part of the Baptist tradition. Now, I know we've got a lot of different kind of ideas spilling off of that, but I'm just talking generally about the Baptist tradition, that the authority is in the local church. And Baptists are very proud about that, that the local church is the authority and so forth. These people were very proud about that. But what they found was that they had to form, or not, they didn't have to, but they decided to form associations. All right? And why, and the reason they did that, if I had, let me just draw this. And so they decided, you've got a local church here and a local church here and a local church here. You've got local churches spread throughout various parts of England. What you want to do is you want to form an association, not to tell those local churches what to do. That's not the job of the association. The job of the association, though, is to see what we have in common. Can we understand what each local church has in common with the next local church? And that will give us strength if we can figure out what we have in common. And so as the Baptist grew and developed, these people, both the General Baptist and the Calvinist Baptist, both of them formed kind of associations to give kind of a Baptist point of view about things. So what I'd like to do here, because remember ecclesiology is our major kind of theme here, what I'd like to do is just mention some of the things that they discussed, some of the issues that were important to them as they came together in these associations. That's not to take away from the authority of the local church at all, but they come together in these associations and they say, can we give kind of a general Baptist point of view about things? So let me just mention some of them. Number one is what they call the gathering of churches. The gathering of churches. By the gathering of churches, what they meant was that you don't belong to a church by virtue of your birth. You know, if you're born into the Anglican Church, you're baptized in the Anglican Church, that's going to be your church. No. You belong, the idea of the church is a gathered community. It's people who voluntarily and willfully come into the body of Christ. That's the Baptist point of view. So you don't belong to a church just because you were born in it or just because your parents or your grandparents were in that church. You belong to a church by virtue of your kind of conversion and willing to join the church. So that was one thing. A second thing they talked about, of course, was, of course, believers' baptism. They didn't believe in infant baptism as the Anglicans did or the Catholics did. They believed in the baptism of adults. Only believers are baptized. Some of these things are going to sound familiar to you if you're coming from a Baptist tradition, but believers' baptism. So a third thing they talked a lot about was how should we relate to the unconverted? And many of these Baptist communities were very kind of separatist communities from the larger culture, from the larger world, because they saw the larger culture, the larger world, as contaminating the believers and so forth. So there was this kind of separatist kind of idea among many of the Baptists that we don't want to be part of that broader unbaptized evil world. We don't want to be part of that world. We want to be our own kind of group of believers. So that's a third thing that they talked about. A fourth thing that they talked about was ordination, and we've already mentioned the authority for ordination lies within the local church. So again, the association's not trying to take away from that authority. They're just trying to see, what do we have in common? What do we believe in common about ordination? What kind of Baptist point of view do we have about ordination? So they talk a lot about ordination. They talked also a lot about relationship with the government. How should you relate to the government? And generally, and this was true with the Baptists who came over here, came to the New World, generally they wanted kind of a separation of church and state. But they wanted a separation of church and state, which it's kind of changed today, but they wanted a separation of church and state because they didn't want the state harassing we Baptists because we baptize adults or something like that. They wanted a separation of church and state so that the state would not kind of interfere in the life of this community. So they wanted a clear kind of delineation of responsibilities. So they were, in a sense, afraid of state interference, of governmental interference upon their religious life. And that's going to be true over here in America also. The Baptists would be very strong proponents in America of separation of church and state. I think it's very interesting. This has nothing to do with anything, so don't try to make any connection whatsoever. But I think it's very interesting that when we talk about separation of church and state today in our discussions, the reason people are talking about separation of church and state is because they're afraid of what influence the church is going to have upon the state. So they don't want religious influence upon the state. They want maybe a secular state, so they want a separation of church and state. That's really fascinating to me because that's not the original reason for the discussion of separation of church and state. The original reason was this Baptist reason: we don't want the state controlling the church. We've kind of turned it around today and kind of put the horse before the cart before the horse on this thing. That's kind of an odd thing. So, okay, just a couple of other things. They talked about missionary work, of course. These people were very missionary-minded. So they talked about the missionary work that all these local churches were engaged in or endeavoring to do. So they also talked about church worship. They talked a lot about kind of what we would call church liturgy. And it was much more simple, of course, than the Anglican liturgy, much more simple than the Anglican worship. Sometimes it did include things, however, like the washing of feet as almost kind of sacramental in a way. But they didn't call it a sacrament, but foot washing, and because they saw Jesus as an example of that and so forth. So they also talked about discipline. How do you discipline the members of the church? You know, each local church has its own way, but let's talk about it, see if we have a Baptist point of view of discipline of the people of the church. So they talked a lot about that. Okay, and they also talked about domestic life. As a good Baptist and a good believer and a good Christian, what's the relationship between husband and wife? How should you raise your children? That kind of thing. So these people were very much interested in what is a Baptist point of view. What is a Baptist? How should Baptists kind of envision their own life and the life of the world in which we live in? It didn't mean, once again, that the association was going to impose this upon every local church. Every local church is independent. Every local church is autonomous. Local church has their own right to make their own decisions. But there was a point of view that they thought were, was kind of a Baptistic point of view. So, okay, so that's the forming of associations and the forming of associations for that reason. Okay, the last one here is division in the ranks. Division in the ranks. Okay, so first of all, the general Baptists or the Arminian Baptists. What happened to the general Baptist and the Arminian Baptists? Well, actually, what happened to them is there were Baptists, General Baptists, Arminian Baptists, who started to question the divinity of Christ. They started to question whether Christ was really divine or whether he was just a good person to be followed. And a lot of the General Baptists in England at this time became Unitarians. They no longer believed in the Trinity. They believed in only one God, and they believed that Jesus was a good man and a good model, a good example for us to follow. So they became Unitarians. So that 100 years later or so, basically these general Baptists merge into what becomes known eventually as Unitarianism. And Unitarianism as a movement began in England, and then it came over here to America. So they go kind of the liberal route, I guess you could say. Okay, what about, in terms of division in the ranks, what about the Calvinist Baptists? What about these particular Baptists? Well, the Calvinist Baptists in England and even here in America, they reacted to that liberalism that they saw in the general Baptists. So they reacted by going to the kind of extreme right, and the Calvinist Baptists became ultra-Baptists. They became hyper-Calvinists. They out-Calvin Calvin. the Calvinist Baptists, a hyper-Calvinism. So you have an extreme kind of left-wing, Unitarian kind of wing, and you've got an extreme right-wing. You've got hyper-Calvinists here on the right wing of things, and some stayed kind of in the middle. But you do have two extremes being formed. The hyper-Calvinists were so hyper that once they were in their associations discussing missionary work, they decided, we don't need missionaries, thank you very much. Because God has predestined before the world began who is going to be saved, predestined before the world began who's going to be lost, so we don't need missionaries to go and tell people that. If God's going to save them, God's going to save them. If they're lost, they're lost, period. So that's kind of the hyper-Calvinists. So that's where the Baptist went. That's where they evolved. Now, if some of you are Baptist background, now there's a lot of Baptist denominations today. In my American Christianity course, I have a slide which shows various Baptist denominations in various parts of the world. So there's probably 99 Baptist denominations in the world today. Some of them are very, very interesting names and so forth. I don't know if I could find that. Maybe I should show that here too. But that's what happened with the Baptists. But notice the Baptists are they're an independent movement. They're a separatist movement. They're no longer Anglican. They're out of there. So what we've had is, because ecclesiology is kind of the central point of discussion, what we've had now is two independent groups being formed, the Congregationalists and the Baptists, both in England and here in the New World. So, now, we're going to see some reaction to all of this, but who wants to talk about the Congregationalists or the Baptists? Anybody? Anything here about, do you see kind of the evolution of these independent separatist groups into their own kind of denominational structure in that? Yeah. There were. In the 17th century in England and starting into the 18th century, the two extremes became pretty strong. Unitarianism, and there was a strength in hyper-Calvinism too. But there are middle groups, and there are middle groups more and more being formed until, as I say, until today, probably have 100 or so Baptist, kind of technically Baptist denominations. So yeah, there were middle groups. But there were a lot of them. Yeah. But those are the two wings, in a sense. Something else, the Congregationalists, the Baptists. You see what's going on with these separatists, with these independent people in terms of ecclesiology, right? As a kind of a reaction to the Anglican Church. Okay. I'm on page 13. What I'd like to do now is do reactions to the Puritans. So the Puritans come over here to America. We've had them come on over here, but not everybody was happy with the Puritans, and so there were certain reactions to the Puritans, and out of these reactions came more denominations and more independent, more separatist groups came out of the reactions. But when you look at the reactions to the Puritans, there were three major ones. And I actually lecture on this also in my American Christianity course, but none of you have been in that course, so we're okay. All right. Let me talk about the three major ones. I've listed them here. The first major reaction to the Puritans was a man by the name of Roger Williams. Now, Roger Williams has an interesting history. He is one of the most important men in the 17th century, persons in the 17th century in American religious history. No doubt about that. He is a need-to-know name, Roger Williams. So let me just say a couple of things about Roger Williams and what made him so important as a reaction to the Puritans. Roger Williams was born in England. And he was born in England into an Anglican family. So he began his kind of pilgrimage in the Anglican Church in England. So that's where he started. So, all right. And then the family moves over here to Boston. And while he's living in Boston, he kind of becomes a Puritan. He's staying within the Anglican Church, but he's wondering if the Anglican Church can be purified from within. So he kind of moves into this kind of Puritan tradition. However, once he's a Puritan, he starts to be convinced that maybe the Anglican Church isn't going to be salvaged at all. So he starts to become and have thoughts while he's here in Boston now. Now, Boston was a very Puritan place, and it really had a control on both religious life and civic life. But he starts to have separatist thoughts, independent thoughts, while he's here in Boston. But that's not going to do. So he's got to get out of here. If he's going to be a separatist, if he's going to be an independent, he's got to leave Boston. And so he leaves Boston, and he heads south through the wilderness, literally, and he founds a place called what? How does he name it? Providence. Well, there's a good biblical name, Providence. And he founds a place called Providence. And he founds it based on a lot of principles, but there's one major principle that he believes is a biblical principle. So he founds Providence on that principle. And that principle is the principle of religious freedom, religious liberty. He believes that there needs to be a colony of people where people can come who are free to practice religion, free to practice any religion they want, free to be not religious. But he believes in total, absolute religious freedom, religious liberty, and Providence is the place where he's going to do that, as opposed, of course, to the Puritans up here who have too much tight a hold on the religious life of the people here up here in Boston. So he founds it on religious liberty. Now, here's what I'd like to just take note of this, if you will. Notice I use the term religious liberty, religious freedom. I didn't use the term religious toleration. Religious toleration is, well, we're tolerant. We really might disagree with these people. No, religious freedom is absolute freedom as far as Roger Williams was concerned. So he founds this settlement, and he calls Providence, and the place eventually is called, of course, called Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, which has nothing to do with anything, so don't try to. But the longest name of a state in among the 50 states is Rhode Island, because technically the state name is Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. So because it's the longest state name of all the 50 states. So there you go. There's a little known fact. You probably weren't talking about that at breakfast this morning. But there it is, that he founds Providence and gets this thing established. Okay, now let me just say what happens to Roger Williams, because it's important for this kind of reaction to the Puritans. If he's a separatist, if he's an independent guy, if he wants total religious freedom, religious liberty, he finds he's got to kind of connect to some group, and so he connects to the Baptists down there. These are English Baptists, Welsh Baptists, and actually in 1639, he helps them to build their church, which is now, you can see that church in Providence, is not the original church, of course, it's a colonial church, but he helps them to build the first Baptist church in America, because he decides to connect with the Baptists. However, for you Baptists out there, you can't hold to him for too long, because he's only a Baptist for 3 or 4 weeks or so. Roger Williams ended up as an extreme independent. He ended up as what we call a seeker. Now, that's extreme on the independent wing of things. A seeker is someone who doesn't belong to any denomination, is seeking the right religion, seeking the right, and in his case, seeking the right kind of aspect of Christianity and so forth. So he ends up as a seeker. And his biographer, Perry Miller, said, Roger Williams began to think, he got down to a place where he began to think maybe there are only two Christians in the world, him and his wife. And then he began to doubt his wife. So if you're a seeker and you get down to only one Christian, you're in trouble. But that's where Roger Williams ended up, as a seeker. So it's interesting. His pilgrimage is just a fascinating story. As Anglican, Puritan, Separatist, Baptist, seeker. That's the pilgrimage of Roger Williams. But he is a definite, no doubt, thorn in the flesh to the Puritans, because he's gonna found a colony that is contrary to what he experienced here in Boston, contrary to what he felt was the kind of the bigotry and the tight control that the Puritans had to religious life in Boston. He wants a place where people can come and be free to be religious, free to be not religious. So that's the first reaction to the Puritans, no doubt about that. Okay, so Roger Williams. Any question about Roger Williams? Very, very important. In our American Christianity course, we really need to zero in on Roger Williams because he's pretty critical. Okay, number two are the Quakers. Second reaction to the Puritans is the Quakers. All right, and the Quakers were founded here at very bottom of the list here. Quakers were founded in England by a man by the name of George Fox. That's just a need-to-know name in terms of where this whole ecclesiology stuff is going here. But George Fox, the founder of the Quakers. Now, George Fox had been an Anglican, of course. Long story short on George Fox, he had been an Anglican. But he started to get this feeling that God is working with him in a very personal way, apart from the structure of the church, apart from the liturgy of the church. And so he started to get the feeling that God works, there's this kind of inner light of Christ working in him and through him. And George Fox began to preach this gospel of the inner light of Christ. And George Fox eventually founds an independent movement. And the independent movement were called the Quakers. Okay. And the reason they were called the Quakers, and by the way, the if you want to call the Quakers a denomination, the denomination grew pretty rapidly. George Fox began preaching, and then a few years later, there were 50,000 Quakers in England. Now, if you want to know the name of the Quaker, the reason for quaking is because in the very early founding of the movement, there was a lot of dancing going on among these Quakers. And so the term Quaker became a term of derision for these people because their meetings, their religious meetings, were so raucous with all the dancing and all the shouting going on and everything. Now, is that how you, when you think of a Quaker meeting today, do you think of this or not? What do you think of when you think of a Quaker meeting? Have any of you been to a Quaker meeting by any chance? A Quaker meeting house? You think of rice cakes? Oh, Quaker. Oh, oatmeal. That didn't immediately come to my mind, Jesse, but that's the Quaker oats, right?
Yeah.
Quaker oats. Are Quaker oats made in Pennsylvania, I wonder? Because Pennsylvania became the Quaker state because it was founded by a Quaker, William Penn. But Quaker oats, the Quaker state, the Quakers. Do you think of anything else? If you think of a meeting, if you went into a Quaker meeting, what would it be like? Yeah. Right. It would be a very silent meeting. Women would be in the. This isn't true among kind of evangelical Quakers today, but in the traditional Quaker meeting, the women are on one side, the men are on the other side. The meeting is silent, and only there's no liturgy as such. They don't practice the sacraments, and they don't preach in a text. They don't have ordained ministers and so forth. As someone is moved by the Spirit, stands up to speak and so forth. Well, that's pretty different from these Quakers when they were originally founded. So they did settle down. There was a settling down, and the reason for that was because these meetings that they had were so raucous. There were enough Quakers that felt we are getting really off track in terms of what religious life should be like. And so there was this opposite, in a sense, this reaction to this, so they did settle down, and the meetings are very quiet and moving of the Spirit and so forth. But there's no doubt that the Quakers were a reaction to the Puritans. All right, now, long story short, just to get them over to these shores, because we've got this separatist group called the Quakers now, this independent group. Now, they're calling themselves the Quakers. And by the way, so this would be the third kind of denomination that we've seen, right? We've seen the Congregationalists, we've seen the Baptists, now we see the Quakers. Okay, they come over to these shores to try to come into Boston, and they weren't allowed in Boston. The first two Quaker women, in fact, who came over here were sent back on the ship back to England. They weren't even allowed to disembark. Then the Quakers started to come and get into Boston. So how did the Boston civil authorities handle the Quakers in Boston? Do you know? Because we can't have this. We can't have this independent movement. We can't have this separatist movement. It's a heresy and it's going to cause civil disorder. Well, they began to hang them on the Boston Common. So when you walk through the Boston Common, remember that Boston Common was hanging ground in the 18th and 19th centuries. They used to hang people there. So and they used to hang Quakers on the Boston Common. And one of the Quaker women, long story short, if you're facing the State House, if you're looking at the State House face on the right-hand side, there's a woman sitting down, Mary Dwyer. She was one of the ones hanged on the Boston Common. So there's her statue there. So that's how the Puritans tried to suppress this independent group as these Quakers. Now, eventually, they got a hold here. But as they got a hold here, they were not welcomed. They really were not welcomed. If you start hanging people on the Boston Common, you're telling them we're not happy to have you. This is not a this is not a nice greeting, you know. Welcome to Boston, and by the way, we're going to hang you. But so where do they go? Where are they going to go? Where are they going to go? They're going to go to Providence. They're going to go to Providence. They were welcomed in Rhode Island by Roger Williams. He didn't happen to like the Quakers, by the way, theologically. He didn't like their theology. But he welcomed them into Rhode Island because this is a place of religious liberty. They flooded down to Providence and Rhode Island in great numbers from Boston because there they were welcome. That is the second reaction to the Puritans. Okay, the third reaction to the Puritans is a very important woman in church history, and certainly in our case in American church history, and her name is Anne Hutchinson. Anne Hutchinson was a Puritan living in Boston. But Anne Hutchinson did something. Now, remember, this is a woman doing this now. Anne Hutchinson did something that she never, ever should have done. She brings people into her home to discuss theology in her home. Now, and some of the theology of her mentor, John Cotton, she agreed with, and some she didn't agree with, but she felt that if we look at the Bible and we discuss theology, this is really a wonderful thing to do. Well, the Puritan leadership in Boston did not like this for two reasons. Number one, they didn't like her theology. They felt that she was discussing a kind of an antinomian theology and so forth. They weren't happy with her theology. But number two, she was breaking all kinds of social norms because you had a woman teaching theology. And you can't have this. This woman is not ordained. She's not prepared to minister in this way. So Anne Hutchinson was a real, what shall we say, reaction to the Puritans here in America. No doubt about that. As a woman teaching theology, she was a real reason. Okay, so there's Anne Hutchinson. Now, where's poor Anne? Where's she going to go? Where's Anne Hutchinson? She had all these children. Her husband died. Where's she going to head for? Jesse, Providence. She's going to go down to Providence. Rhode Island is going to welcome Anne Hutchinson and take her in because religious liberty. So they're going to allow this woman, as Quaker women, by the way, in Rhode Island were already speaking, they're going to allow this woman to speak, to teach theology and so forth. Now, if you're at the State House, you're looking at the State House, you see Mary Dwyer on one side. On the other side, this is the statue at the State House. You see, this is the statue of Anne Hutchinson. So there she is, a real religious liberty person, you know. And so that's why the State House has these two women on either side of the State House, because of their feelings of religious liberty, religious freedom. Okay, so anything about Anne Hutchinson? She, long story short on Anne Hutchinson, she eventually moved into upper state New York. I'm not sure why exactly she left Providence, but she moved into upper state New York, and there was a real kind of little bit of warfare there between the colonists who lived there and the Native Americans who lived there, and she was killed in an attack, and some of her family were killed in an attack, and that's how she died in Upper State New York. It's kind of a sad ending for Anne Hutchinson. But in any case, those three reactions, Roger Williams, the Quakers, and Anne Hutchinson, that is really calling into question Puritan ecclesiology and calling into question Puritan theology as well. So that was really important. Okay, so questions about this? Have I given you a 5-second break? I haven't. Bless your hearts. 5 seconds. You deserve 5 seconds today. So just crash, just rest. And maybe while you're doing that, just rest. This is something I'm going to write on the board if I find... I'll just write this over here. Okay. I'll just use this in a minute. Religion and commerce. Any questions? Resting, crashing. Okay, so you give me your questions. We meet in the Lion's Den on Friday, and then Monday we take an exam. And I'll try to get here a little early, give out the exam. Okay. What I'd like to do now is talk about the decline of Puritanism in America and what happened with this decline of Puritanism, and are there any kind of lessons to be learned from this decline of Puritanism? Okay. Why did the Puritans decline? Now, let's take you into Salem, kind of in the 19th century. And they take you down certain streets and say, well, this doesn't only have to be Salem. It could be places like Ipswich probably or Hamilton. I'm just familiar with a couple of those sites in Salem. But you go into Salem in the 19th century and you go down the streets there. What they're going to show you are beautiful 19th century homes, very elaborate 19th century homes. And sometimes they're going to point these out and saying these were the homes of the Puritans. Well, as a matter of fact, they weren't the homes of the original Puritans. And so what's going on here? What's the first reason for the decline of Puritanism? The initial Puritans, when they made money, they poured their money back into the churches, not into their families. They poured their money back into the churches or into the civil society. But they didn't pour their money back into themselves. So the original Puritans made lots of money. Why did they make lots of money, by the way, those original Puritans? Why were they so... How did they become so wealthy? What would you think? Some of them would have owned slaves, but I was thinking of any kind of personal kind of... maybe personal habits and that. Because what did the Puritans... How did they think you should live a personal life? Very frugal, very strict, very frugal, very careful. That's how they lived their personal lives. They believed that that was biblical. And so with that because they were living such frugal, careful, strict lives, and they were building their businesses, they were making lots of money in these businesses. And so they were turning this money over back into the business, and that grew and grew and grew, or back into the civil government. So what happened, however, was that the second generation, third generation, fourth generation started to take that money and use it for themselves. So the first reason for the decline of Puritanism was an increase in wealth. So those 19th century homes that you see, those very elaborate, those very beautiful homes that you see in Salem, the original Puritans would never have built homes like that. They would have never poured the money into their own selves. They poured their money into their businesses. So with this increase in wealth with the Puritans, that was one of the reasons for the decline of Puritanism. So now, a second reason for the decline of Puritanism was a diminishing of religious enthusiasm. The first generation or second generation were very religiously enthusiastic. They built a city on a hill that all people in the world could see that we are living. This wasn't a theocracy, here in Boston, but that we are living according to the laws of God. And, you know, this is something, this is kind of like Geneva, kind of a model city for people to look at and see how Christians form a community and so forth. But the second, third, and fourth generations lost that evangelical zeal. They weren't interested in that kind of evangelical zeal anymore. So the Puritan ideal of a society ruled by God, you know, overseen by God, that died out with it, among the Puritans. So what I've done is I've just, I should do a PowerPoint kind of for this. It seems like that would be pretty easy to set up, but maybe I should do a PowerPoint for this too. Okay, I've got my homework. But what that meant was that you're kind of going around in a circle here, because I can't tell you which came first. I mean, it'd be nice to be able to say that. Which came first? Did they lose their religious zeal? Or no, which came first? Did they become really wealthy? And by becoming wealthy and pouring the money back into themselves, did that cause them to lose their religious zeal? Or did they lose their religious zeal, and therefore, because they weren't thinking in terms of religion as the center of their lives, then they become very interested in commerce and wealth, and so is that the way it went? Well, what I would say, it's not one or the other, it's both and. So instead of seeing as one precedes the other, you have to see it as a cycle, as a circle. And going around in this circle is what caused the decline of Puritanism then. So that became very, that became really critical for Puritanism was not able to sustain itself for more than a second generation or so. By the time you get to the fourth generation, fifth generation of Puritans, they are not living or believing like their parents or their grandparents or their great-grandparents lived and believed. So now an example of this now is, an example of this is something that happened between 1657 and 1662. The people who had been Puritans, developed what was called a halfway covenant, and they developed that covenant during those years. Okay? Now, the halfway covenant meant that, in the old days, you could only belong to a church if you gave an expression of conversion. If you said, I'm a child of Christ, I believe, I become converted, I want to join the church. Or, if in terms of the, because these people are baptizing children, infants, or I want my infant to be baptized in the church because I want my infant to be raised in the community of believers and so forth. Okay, that's the old days. Now, as they finally developed the halfway covenant among the Puritans, the halfway covenant said, you can belong to a church if you're a good moral, ethical person. You don't have to give witness to some conversion experience. You don't have to give witness that you're a child of Christ. You can belong to the church. Just, you know, if you're a good person, the church will take you in. The halfway covenant will allow for that. Or if you're not a believer and you'd like your child to be baptized and your infant to be baptized in the church, that's fine. So what happened with the halfway covenant is that the church basically opened the doors to people belonging to the church who wouldn't otherwise in previous generations have been able to belong to the church. And what the halfway covenant was a demonstration that the Puritans had lost their kind of original understanding of the church. They had lost their, you know, you don't get any double election people in this halfway covenant. They had lost their theology, kind of lost their way. Many of these Puritans then they weren't attached to the Church of England anymore. Many of them, of course, they became Congregationalists, and eventually some of them became Unitarians even, where they denied the Trinity. So they went that route, but that's the decline of Puritanism. Okay, so now what about anything about that decline of Puritanism? Do any of you use Max Weber's book, Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, for any of your courses? Anybody at all use that book for any course? Okay, it's a very interesting book. and you know, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, that Protestant ethic of frugality, saving, consciousness, conscious working, vocation, as foundational for capitalism in the Western world. Very interesting book if you get a chance. Add it to your summer reading list. Have a good day, and we'll see you Friday in the Lion's Den.
This is Dr. Roger Green in his course, Reformation to the Present. This is session number 9 on Puritanism.